And many are blindsided by impacts for which they had no warning or means of preparation. This is why I'm calling for a universal early warning system coverage within 5 years. And it is why I am asking that all governments tax the windfall profits of fossil fuel companies. Let's redirect that money to people struggling with rising food and energy prices and to countries suffering loss and damage caused by the climate crisis.
The words of Antonio Guterres, UN Secretary General, at the COP27 Climate Change Conference, November 2022. The effects of the climate crisis are set to have a disproportionate impact on developing countries. Significant attention is now being paid to what should be done and by whom to mitigate the consequences and uphold human rights. So, what does this climate justice mean in practice? Yamid Danye is Director of Climate Justice at Open Society Foundations, a non-profit that works with organisations and individuals who seek to address profound racial, economic and political inequalities. She describes what climate justice means to her and how developed nations in particular should learn from the past in their approach.
Climate justice is about people. People is at the center of it. The reason why I am insisting about this is because for a long time, we have approached tackling climate change, you know, from a very scientific and technical point of view, but not necessarily putting people at the center. And when you look at climate justice, it very much stems from the tale of injustice. Those who have contributed the least to the problem are those suffering the most. It's undeniable that, you know, we need to look into the issue of climate change by recognizing that the collapse of the environment as we know it is very much due to the development choices made by developed countries, and especially choices over relying on fossil fuel and extractivism, and upon which the developed world became materially richer, and at the expense of vulnerable communities, marginalized communities. So I think this gap is what is becoming a focus on climate justice, to try to rebalance and to make sure that when it comes to decision-making, to the processes, to the consultative processes, that actually vulnerable countries, communities, marginalized communities are part of the solutions, are on the table as well. So I think this is a procedural equity dimension of climate justice, but it's also the outcome to make sure that they are not left behind. We have used, you know, the slogan of sustainable development and leaving no one behind a lot, but the justice element and as part of the climate justice, at the core of climate justice, is about making sure that the rich are not just profiteering, you know, from what we're going to do. And this is important because even when we want to do, we act in good faith and want to do the right thing, we can get it wrong. If we just look at, you know, going from A to B, not looking at the lessons from the past and not putting the people at the center, we may still get false solutions. In order to do the revolution that needs to happen to decarbonize the world, you know, we would need 6 times more, you know, to meet the needs of renewable energies. And this means 6 times more extraction. We need to make sure that we don't repeat the same mistakes of the past by having this dash to renewable to result into land grabbing. This request from compensation and liability is probably legitimate from developing countries. It's legitimate for them to request this, kind of reparation for damages that they have not caused. But what they are asking more importantly is, okay, if you do not want to get into that road of reparation, show at least the solidarity and showcase the right innovative cooperation necessary to make sure that, you know, we are in a position to be more resilient. You cannot use the excuse of liability and compensation to do nothing. You know, there needs to be at least, you know, cooperation and solidarity. And it's not charity. It's solidarity, it's responsibility, it's accountability, because ultimately it's, you know, moving all together that is going to get us, you know, where we need to be.
Jacinta Falmau is Pacific Regional Campaign Specialist at 350.org, an international movement working to end the age of fossil fuels and build a world of community-led renewable energy for all. She reflects on recent successes and the work still to be done on climate justice.
World leaders have established a loss and damage finance facility at COP27. And so, you know, it's to ensure that countries who are currently grappling with the climate crisis receive, you know, the resources they need to recover what they've lost. And so, you know, I feel like the next steps is putting that into practice. What does that look like on the ground? But there's been so many other things that, you know, we can celebrate. You know, over the last decade, communities have kept a whopping 500 million tons of coal in the ground just in Australia. And Australia is definitely one of the biggest countries who exports coal. There's an Our Islands, Our Home campaign, which is led by First Nations, the Torres Strait Islanders here in Australia. And it's led by 8 claimants who took the Australian government to the UN for violating their rights due to the inaction of climate change. And I think in September this year, they actually got a response from the UN and they won their case. And so, we're looking at how much we need to do it in the short amount of time that we need to do that. There's still a lot of things we can, you know, be proud of, a lot of the work that we've had, especially coming out of COVID. I'm very happy to say that there has been improvement in the climate and environmental movement space. Australia still remains the world's biggest exporter of coal pollution. There's at least 70 new coal mines and expansions that are being proposed. And so while we have kept a lot in the ground and, you know, our movement is growing, the coal fossil fuel industry is also doing the same thing, where they are tripling their production and doing it a lot quicker because they know that, you know, fossil fuels like coal, you know, they will, I guess, end soon. And so they're trying to make as much money as they can while they can. You know, where we can make a lot more progress is more ambition from high emitters to phase out fossil fuels. We need to be a lot more clear and in demanding why we need to stay below 1.5. We can always do with more listening to those most affected. I think First Nations justice, there's still a lot of work to be done there in Indigenous rights. The power we need to push for these changes can only come from communities and, you know, people like us to demand it.
Meredith James is senior counsel at Canadian law firm Woodward & Company, and a member of the organisation Lawyers for Climate Justice. Here she provides the lawyer's perspective and outlines how we should create law that avoids what's known as climate blindness.
If the laws that we pass don't actively consider and strive to understand existing inequalities, I've heard the term climate blind as a way to capture some of this, is that if you're not looking to understand those impacts, then you may miss them entirely. So how could exacerbate an existing inequality? I think you could take an example of building retrofits, for example. People living in unrenovated high-rise towers in urban environments, they may be economically disadvantaged or otherwise. Making sure that they are prioritized to receive upgrades to address severe climate impacts, flooding, power outages, extreme weather events, spending to address climate impacts. There's a risk that it will go to those who are already economically advantaged because they're best placed to access funding programs. So making sure that funding programs are designed to reach the economically disadvantaged peoples would be an example of, maybe it's a combination of law and policy that can address that it could risk exacerbating inequalities if it's not properly designed. The story behind the American Bar Association climate resolution that happened a couple of years ago offers a good example of how we can start to address this climate blindness. As I understand what happened, and was that there was a report looking at the barriers to decarbonization from a technical perspective, and a group of lawyers took on seeking to understand what the legal barriers were to operationalizing or putting into practice these technical options. I think that's a good example of tackling climate blindness is to, for in the legal profession, is to look at where are things that our profession is engaging with that are holding us back from taking action on climate change, and taking action on climate change in a way that is aware of these rights implications of climate change and these justice implications of climate change. And where we could look at other places for climate justice and climate competency is another term that we've used, could be integrated is in training in law schools, looking at taking climate change out of the environmental law world and into every practice area. I think that's one of the key things to start looking at is that climate change isn't only an environmental issue, and it's not only environmental lawyers who should be engaged with it. And the other part for lawyers is in the licensing component. We have competency requirements that we have to achieve in order to be licensed to practice law, and climate change could be a component of that. Given the scale and scope and duration of climate change, we're past the point where things are ever going to be the same as they have been in the past. And learning how to stay up to speed with what does climate change mean for the practice of law is going to be a competency that new lawyers and current lawyers will need to have.